So now we'll move on to...
Well, thanks very much. My name's Nick Hare. I'm not a professional war gamer. I'm an analytical consultant, but for most of the last 10 years, I've worked in defense intelligence as head of a team whose role was to look at the way that intelligence analysts operated and to try and work out ways that they could improve both the processes they used and the ways that they communicated to decision makers and the impact that their information had on those decision makers. I do have an interest in games. Some of the things that we did with analysts were game-like, scenario evaluation, red teaming, scenario development, and so on. But I think games also give us a means to understand how people approach decision making in a fairly controlled way. What I want to talk about is what creative thinking is, how we understand that, what it does in the context of a decision, why it's important, and some thoughts, not definite conclusions, about what the characteristics are of games that can encourage us to use creative thinking. I suppose one of the things that prompted me to think about these sorts of issues is something I call theme fade. This might be something that, it might just be me, it might be something that a lot of people experience, but it's something that I've noticed time and again when playing games. When I first played Twilight Struggle, I was thinking very much, you know, what would Stalin do? What would he do here? You know, we'll blockade Berlin. That'll teach those capitalist pig dogs a lesson about the power of collective action. And you know, a game like the 30 Years' War, you think, well, what can I do to protect my fellow Protestants? Even in a game like Agricola, which many of you might have played. When I first played, it was very much a question of, you know, how should I approach this problem of getting a farm together in the Renaissance era? You know, do I want wheat, or do I want to plow a field, or should I collect some wood? All of those are very much, you know, well-defined game options, but that's not how I approached thinking about the problem. It was what ought I to do as a farmer. Now, when I've played these games over and over again, eventually you start feeling a bit more like this guy. It no longer feels like you're playing the theme. You start playing the game. So with Twilight Struggle, you stop thinking, well, blockading Berlin sounds fun, let's do that. And you start thinking, well, if I don't blockade Berlin till the end of this turn, he might not have a three card, but you know, and then again, the scoring card hasn't come out yet, so perhaps. And it's, you stop thinking about it in terms of the theme, and you think about it really in terms of what options you have and what their impacts will be. And it becomes much more like a well-defined decision problem. I find theme fade quite sad. I like that early stage when you're playing a game and exploring options and thinking about it not as a defined decision problem, but in terms of, you know, what real world problems you might be solving. All the things actually that Graham was just touching on. But I think it tells us something interesting about the way that people approach characterizing decisions. And that tells us something about how people do that in real life. And so some of the things I'm going to talk about are ways in which failure to think creatively can lead to real life decision errors. So first of all, what is creative thinking? I ought to define that first. And I want to sort of slightly rescue creative thinking from what I call the beanbag brigade. You know, creative thinking is a fundamental part of cognition. It fulfills a role within decision making that I would characterize as the identification of potential answers to questions, and particularly the potential answers to the questions of what things can I do and what things might happen. And creative thinking fulfills the role of throwing up potential answers to those questions. And if we want to think of the kind of direct opposite of creative thinking, the other half of it, it's what you might call critical thinking, which is the use of information to try and whittle those options down, to test the hypotheses about what might happen in the world. This is really just the scientific method, you know, that you first generate hypotheses, and then you use the information you have to try and whittle them down, and eventually that can be characterized in decision theoretical terms, and you can think about it as maximizing your expected utility, and it all becomes very well defined. So sort of in decision theory, I think in terms of the function of creative types of thinking is they are designed to find potential things that we can do and to find potential things that might happen. And that distinction is something the distinction between creative and critical thinking has been re-identified many times over the last couple of thousand years as, you know, inductive versus deductive, or divergent versus convergent thinking. We're not generally cognitively aware of this process. When we are thinking about a problem, we very rapidly iterate between the two types of processes. In much the same way that when we open our eyes and see the world, we're not really aware of what the visual processing software in our brain is doing. When we think about a decision problem, we're not generally aware of how we arrive at some sort of conclusion about what the best thing to do is. But it can be characterized in these terms. And I think the theory side of how we should characterize the problem of arriving at a decision suggests that there should be a sequential element. So new problems, relatively unexplored areas, should invite us to use creative approaches more to help characterize the problem, to help identify ways in which the space of activity can be explored. And then as we gather more information, as time goes on, we begin to whittle those options down into something where there's a few things that can be tackled enumeratively, where we can say, okay, well, I'm going to be doing one of these three or four things, and I'm going to appraise them individually and work out what the best thing to do is. In terms of the cognitive architecture, how do we actually go about doing these things? This is a bit controversial. There's certainly no conclusion about this. But I think the prevailing consensus is that we actually do have specialised bits of software in our brain to do these things separately. So we have different architectures for doing creative types of thinking compared to the kinds of architectures that we have for critical thinking. You might have come across the terms System 1 and System 2, which kind of captures those two modes of thinking. And it also suggests that we can predict the kinds of approaches that people will take when presented with some sort of decision problem. So if you're given a well-defined set of options to appraise, you will tend to approach them in a critical thinking System 2 type way. But if you're given a whole host of different options or a badly structured problem, you'll tend to approach it in a System 1 type way. So I have some questions here. So the first one, what's the smallest positive square number that's divisible by 20? That's something that you can certainly attack in an enumerative and deductive way. You can go through the numbers one by one, or if you've got a modicum of maths, you might have an insight about that. The second one, however, what's the biggest selling music single ever? I would predict that you're not going to approach that by thinking of every single single that you've ever heard of and working out which one you think is most likely to be correct. What you're going to do there is start clustering. Okay, what kinds of categories might we expect to fall into that? How might we approach this problem? Which would be an associative, creative thinking way of approaching that problem. Now, finally, this kind of question here, which is a sort of mix of the two, where we get faced with, actually, there's 50 states. Which are the only three without an A, I, or O in the name? I predict that you'd probably use quite a cognitively demanding iterative approach here, where you would think, okay, what states do I know about on the East Coast or the West Coast? What are the states that begin with A? Let's rule those out. And I think, in the context of games, those sorts of problems where we have a just about manageable range of potential things we can do tend to be where you get analysis paralysis. And I think if you think about the curve of learning a game, it tends not to happen at the beginning when you're exploring the options. It tends not to happen at the end when you're an expert. It tends to happen in the middle, where actually it's you're beginning to narrow down the range of actions that you can do and your understanding of the system. So I'll give you the answers to those at the end. So I think one way to understand, so as I said, there's this sequential element that we tend to use creative thinking when we first encounter a new problem. And we tend to use more critical types of thinking when we have a problem that's well understood. And I think, as far as I'm concerned, that's quite a good explanation. For theme fade, is that at the beginning of a game, we are effectively playing the theme. We're using the theme as a handrail to help us think about what is actually a huge, messy space of potential actions. Once we become expert in the system, in the way that the game works, then we tend to find ourselves being able to characterize the decision problem in terms of one to three potential courses of action. And so we no longer really need the theme. We can think about the mechanics and the system of the game because we understand it well enough not to rely on creative thinking approaches. So you stop, you know, you stop being Napoleon and you just start thinking, well, if I can move that unit or I can play this card, instead of having 100 options, you've narrowed down what clearly seem to be the leading candidates. So why is it important? Sorry, can I see the time? All right. Thanks, we have that money. Great.
10 minutes.
So why is it important? I think my job over the last decade has involved looking at the way that people approach problems in national security. You know, the kinds of problems that I was looking at involved real world versions of the kinds of thing that we were doing yesterday. You know, what should our policy be over a foreign country? You know, how likely is this country to be pursuing a nuclear weapons program? All those sorts of questions. So I kind of had first-hand insight into the way that those things were approached. And when we're thinking about potential decision errors, critical thinking errors are much more highly studied. So if you read about cognitive biases and so on, you'll tend to find that nearly all of them are talking about we're failing to use information in the right way. You know, we're given some potential hypotheses, we're given some information, but we're not using that information to put the right probability on those hypotheses. You know, the various biases tends to be about that sort of error. But I think when creative thinking is neglected, so when people approach a problem which they ought to use creative thinking at least partly to start tackling, and they don't, they use critical thinking approaches, that's where we tend to find really catastrophic decision errors. So a few examples. I mean, if we want to categorize, you know, what the two types of error here, one might be failure to identify alternative options, which we might call fighting the last war, and the other might be failure to identify potential outcomes, potential hypotheses or scenarios which do in fact occur, which is usually called failure of imagination. And both of those errors are like tunnel vision. They will work provided you're looking in the right place. But the point is that it's the things which you aren't looking at then, things that you're not doing that you should be doing, that have a potentially negative impact. So who remembers these guys, right? So Yahoo followed very much the prevailing wisdom about how you make money from a website, which is stickiness. What you wanted to do was to get people to stay on your page for as long as possible. That's how you managed to sell advertising space, was to get people to stay there. So Yahoo did have a search engine. They wanted to be this portal, but at the same time, they had content. They curated things. They had information on the front page, and they wanted you to hang around on the front page so that they could sell space to advertisers. And then, of course, Google came along and realized that's not... There's a completely different model, which turned out to be more successful, which is to be the front page of the internet, but not to have anything else. And in fact, you know, that's the Yahoo, Google has built a technology empire on the back of that. Friends reunited, similarly, like a lot of early social networks, thought the value was in the content. You know, in the context of Friends Reunited, it was all about giving people access to stuff about their school. Whereas actually the value was in having the social network and not the content. And of course, social networks like Facebook, who realized that, were able to entirely dominate that space. Failures of imagination in the real world. It's controversial, 9-1-1, whether or not the Twin Towers attack was a failure of imagination. 9-1-1 Commission report said it was. I'm not sure I totally agree. But the idea here is that something happens that people haven't thought about. They just haven't given it any thought. So in the case of the 9-1-1 attacks, they hadn't identified indicators of those attacks. They hadn't been looking for things like, the things that were cited by the report, which were people training to fly planes, not necessarily training to land them or take them off, and so on. And then New Century, one of the first casualties of the global financial crisis, where that's considered to be something which nobody imagined, nobody was planning for, there was no policy for. So failures of imagination, failure to apply critical thinking approaches, failure treating decision problems as though we can attack them with critical thinking approaches, whereas we should step back and try and say, well, actually, are there things we should be doing which we're not thinking about? Are there outcomes which might occur which we're not thinking about? Can lead to significant real-world impacts. So finally, what are the characteristics of games that will encourage us to tend to use creative thinking attacks on how we are best or what sorts of decisions we ought to take? So as I said, you know, creative thinking is one of many tools that we use, but it's optimal to problems where there are lots and lots of options. But I think just coming up with some examples of games, which I, from my own personal experience, encourage you to think creatively. A lot of them are, there are actually quite a few party games, I think, which do this quite successfully. Pictionary, Dixit, Codenames. Has anyone here played Codenames? Yeah, I think, is it good, do you think? I mean, I think it's amazing. I think it's a really good game for really forcing yourself to try and think creatively about things. It forces you to make connections between different words and then to try and communicate that to your team. It's a good example of something where the system is actually very simple. But in as much as the code name you can give can be any English word, you still have a plethora of options, you know, to consider. So you have to approach that from using creative thinking. I think there are games which involve player interaction, which Graham touched on. Graham's disappeared. I keep pointing at him, but he's gone. Oh well. So games which involve player interaction. I've mentioned here A Distant Plane. Who here has played any of the coin games, the counterinsurgency games for Volko Runka? Yeah. So the interesting thing about that is actually in board terms, you do have a predefined set of things that you can do. There's a lot of board mechanics to retain the state of the board, and it can be, you know, characterized fairly mathematically. But the game, the real game, is in the interaction between the players, and it's in the sort of asymmetric objectives that people have. And coming up with creative ways to use that interaction to try and achieve your objective. Just to mention the mega game we played yesterday, very similar characteristics in that the state of the game was sort of narrowly defined by the board, but actually the creativity, the exploration of the space was in the interaction with the other players and thinking about things you might be able to do to try and achieve what objectives you had. So finally, what are the characteristics of games that encourage creative thinking? So this is entirely my own hypothesis, and you should feel free to disagree, but I think the two things are complexity and legibility here. Complexity is to do with the system, the game system itself, and if it presents you with decisions that are not very well characterized, so they're not easily characterized by having a small number of things that you can do. It gives you a wide space of possibility. Player interaction is an example of that, because of course when you're interacting with another player in a free way, there are, you know, an unbounded number of things that you might potentially do to try and influence that player. Complexity is not just about sort of width, it's not just about giving people lots and lots of options, it can also be about depth. So the sense that there are mechanics happening that are not easily translatable from inputs into outputs, that the state of the game will change in ways that are not easy to predict, but which I think this goes back to something else Graham was touching on, which reward exploration. So that the thought that you will become better at something, you'll understand the system better, the more you try things out in it. Which means that the system can't be totally chaotic. There has to be a sense that you can learn to understand the system better by playing with it. But the other thing is legibility. So legibility is the extent to which something you're looking at can be characterized in a way that you will be able to understand. So this is to do with how we can cluster those options that we're given. If we're given 10,000 options, but there's absolutely no way of clustering them into higher level concepts that we can then use to sort of make our decision process machine readable, to make the problem something that we can eventually characterize, then we get totally lost. And I think probably the most ubiquitous tool to help us with legibility is the use of maps. You know, most games use a map in some way to represent the state of the game. Of course, you could represent the state of any game as just a big long number, but we won't then be able to understand what we're doing, which I think brings us back to the concept of theme. And it's why theme is so important. So, as I said, I don't think theme is important because it's fun. Theme is actually important to give us a handrail so that we can begin to navigate what is actually a very complex space of options in a way that we're cognitively able to understand. I think complexity and legibility tend to fight with one another a little bit. You know, the more complex something is, the harder it is to make legible. And I would argue that that's probably one of the tensions of game design. I'll end there. But I'll just say that, you know, I think theme fade, which, as I said, I think is very sad, is inevitable. If we played War in Binny every day for a month, we would start to find ourselves exploiting game mechanics and the like. But it's something that, by thinking about complexity and legibility within games, we can mitigate. Should I just do the? Do people want the answers to those questions? Would it be frustrating if I didn't? Who's got the smallest positive square number divisible by 20? Yeah, of course it is. Biggest selling music single ever?
White Christmas.
Have you been on Google? Was that? Did you know that?
It's a Trivial Pursuit question.
Oh, it's a Trivial Pursuit question. Anyone got? Sorry. Oh, sorry. White Christmas. Bing Crosby's recording of White Christmas. And anyone know those three U.S. states?
Yeah.
Who said Mississippi? How do you spell that? So thanks very much for listening.
Okay, I think one theme we see emerging from all these talks is that as designers, in considering some of these theoretical issues, we become more and more aware of some of the design considerations that we can actually put into the game to achieve the effects that we want. So I don't think thinking through things like creativity or flow or experience in the game is just a theoretical exercise, but it also has some very practical applications.